Welcome to the 41st episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with John Armstrong, author of the novels Gray and Yarn. Also, I just wanted to take a moment and let you know about another books-related podcast that I listen to. I've been doing this over the last several podcasts. One book-related podcast that I often listen to is the show The Book Show. And it is broadcast originally on the NPR station in Albany, New York, WAMC. The host, Gretchen Holbrook-Gerzina, interviews a wide variety of authors, primarily literary and nonfiction authors, but she is an amazing interviewer. She's a writer. She's a writer herself. And again, the show is The Book Show. If you just do a Google search for WAMC, The Book Show, you'll find the website and you'll be able to subscribe to the podcast feed there. I definitely recommend it. It's a great show. Now stay tuned for my interview with John Armstrong.
Well, this is Jeffrey Deaver, author of most recently The Burning Wire and soon to be author of the next continuation James Bond novel. I spend a lot of time writing, a lot of time researching my books, but when I'm not doing that, I love listening to the Reading and Writing Podcast, which you can hear at readingandwritingpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. Today, my guest is John Armstrong, author of the books Gray and his new book Yarn, which is a dystopic science fiction novel mixed with the fashion industry. Armstrong is also the host of his own podcast, if you're just joining us. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Sure. Well, I briefly described Yarn, your new novel, but can you talk about it in a little bit more detail for someone who may not be familiar with you or your novel Yarn?
Well, you had to ask the most difficult question, didn't you? Describing my works, you know what? I actually find that insanely difficult. And when I get the books and there's something written on the back, I think, thank God, you know, here, what is it? And what have I done is actually what I often think. I think it's, you know, it's a sci-fi book. That's true. It is kind of, it's dystopian. It's set in some kind of a bad future. But here's where my own take on it probably differs somewhat from how one might read it. I have a love-hate relationship with the place that I've written about. And part of me thinks it's really cool and amazing, and the other part thinks this is basically hell on earth in some regard. So, I've talked to people about whether it's really dystopian. Everyone says it is, but sometimes I think it's not. So that probably only confuses the matter. It is a world of great riches and, you know, very desperate poor. And the book's a protagonist is a tailor who is in the is really one of the top fashion related people in the world, kind of like an Armani character in a way. And he kind of confronts where he has come from, oddly enough, through a journey that he takes to try and help an old lover.
Okay. So fashion and science fiction, was fashion an interest of yours before you started writing this book? And why'd you decide to write about a topic that, to my knowledge, has rarely been dealt with in science fiction?
You said it has not been dealt with in science fiction?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I think my...
Or correct me if I'm wrong.
I think you're probably mostly right. I mean, there are snippets, like I was reading Philip K. Dick a while ago, and he, you know, he plays around a little bit with what people wear better than some science fiction. I mean, the cliches of science fiction is, the silver leotard, not the leotard, but, you know, like a kind of a space suit, you know, like they'd wear on old sci-fi movies. My interest in fashion arose long ago, back in the 80s when I was in college and actually went to Japan as a foreign exchange student, and I was not interested in fashion at all until that point. The Japanese tend to be much better dressed than we are, a little more formal, with actually a very good materials and interesting textiles and so on. I mean, we're basically in jeans and t-shirts over here. And I kind of got interested in fashion, started buying some things, although not a lot actually fit in Japan. I came back and I'd heard about a place called FIT from some people there. FIT was a Fashion Institute of Technology where some of them wanted to go and study. It's a school in New York. Years later, then I was in New York and thought, hey, maybe I'll go check that place out. And I ended up going and taking some classes and until I kind of flunked out. But
so we're not going to see you on Project Runway one day?
Well, no, I could be the first voted off, certainly. That's very likely. You know, making this stuff is really difficult. I've watched that show a number of times, and it's fascinating, but I really wish we saw more of what they do, the real work, as less of the kind of gossip stuff, because it's actually really interesting.
It is interesting, and when I watch it, not to interrupt you, sorry, when I watch it, just given my knowledge of sewing and the fact that I make quilts, it's astounding to me what they do in the amount of time, especially the one-day challenges. And I often watch it with my wife and just shake my head and say, you know, most people watching this have absolutely no idea the challenge of having to sew a garment and have it fit and have it be, you know, in their words, fashion forward in that amount of time.
Yeah. I mean, I remember working on like, and I did myself a disfavor by selecting a very difficult fabric to work with, which is, you know, a concept people probably don't, if they haven't worked with different kinds of fabric, get. It was like a chiffon kind of thing. And it was slippery, and just getting it to go through the machine mm-hmm. was like a physical contest. You had to grab the stuff and hold it, you know, as you worked the pedal of the sewing machine and like tugged it through and made, and that would still slip off and you'd, it was a disaster. Anyway, that was the course I finally failed. but I'll tell you, at FIT, I had a couple of the most interesting classes I'd ever had, ever. Not that I was a huge fan of school, but there was a fashion, what was it called? It was called the History of Fashion class, and then another called Textile Science. And those two classes, I still think about, it's been a decade or two decades later, I still think about, in fact, I'm in contact with the professors of one of them, and I interviewed him for my podcast, among other things. Why they were so fascinating? You know, I think because in part, we dress every day. We do think about what are we going to wear, and is my shirt itchy, and you know, is it comfortable, or does it fit, or do I look good in it? All those kinds of things, with very little knowledge about how they work, how they're made, and so on. And when I started to see some of that world, it just seemed fascinating. Unlike, say, you know, sword making, for which I have no contact. I'm sure it's fascinating, but I have no mm-hmm. swords in my life. I'm just picking something at random. But clothes, I mean, I've got a pile of them.
Yeah.
All over the place. And one example I like to give is jeans. We all wear jeans. But that they're a specifically engineered garment. That the fabric was engineered in a specific way for a specific, you know, for people who were working in the mines or you know, in the gold rush. You know, mm-hmm. trying to sifting through gunk and goo, trying to find a bit of gold that Levi Strauss like consciously decided. It wasn't, you know, oh, they're gonna blue would be a nice color. It was because that ink or dye, indigo, was gonna make some of the yarns very strong, and then the inside yarns. If you remember old pants, old jeans, where they were very dark and stiff on the outside, but then the inside was white or almost white. It's mm-hmm. a two-layered fabric to be hard, armor-like on the outside, yet soft to the skin on the inside. So, you know, and then the pockets, you know, had it was all thought out. That was all, like, deliberate and engineered, really. Just fascinated me.
Interesting. I mentioned earlier that you have your own podcast, if you're just joining us. What was the impetus behind your podcast and getting started in podcasting?
The idea came from, I decided to podcast my first novel, Gray, back in 2007 when it came out. Being a first novel, having not written any short stories, I mean, no one knew of me. So I thought, and I talked to my publisher, and they thought, let's give it a try. So I think it's not really on the internet free. It's switching. That's another subject. About to sign a contract with Audible for both books. But in the beginning, I recorded the whole thing and made it into, you know, MP3s and put it up online. And I don't quite know what the numbers are, but I mean, tens of thousands of people checked it out. So it was a big success.
That's great.
After it was done, I was left with a really nice microphone that I'd bought and thought, you know, maybe I'll try a podcast. It was, you know, something that was cooler maybe back then. And so I started, you know, asking friends, mostly other writers who I knew. And it has evolved over the couple of years that I've done it into something that I really, really enjoy. It is sometimes technically difficult, but I've spoken really to some people I probably don't have any right speaking to in a way, including a fashion designer, a MIT-trained guy who's gone into food, who blogs, and a bunch of really cool authors. It's a great way to have an interesting conversation with someone you don't really, you know, you've never really met most of the time.
Sure. And I assume that you're planning on continuing?
Yeah. In fact, Yarn was nominated for the Philip K. Dick Award recently. And so I got in touch with all of the other nominated authors. I guess there's six of us in total. And I've already done two interviews there on If You're Just Joining Us.com. And I've got the rest coming up. So it's a kind of fun way to get a behind the scenes look at some of these. Mostly are fairly new authors, but some really interesting books.
That's great. And again, if you want to tell people the URL.
It's if you're just joining us.com. I think if you Google all, you know, if you're just joining us, I think it comes up in the first page.
Great. Great. Well, we've talked about your two novels, Yarn and Gray. What initially drew you to writing? Have you been someone who has been writing since an early age? Is it something that came along at a later point? And you mentioned also a moment ago that you had not really published many short stories when your first novel came out. So I wonder if you are the type of writer that you never really worked on short stories, you would just went straight into your first novel.
Well, let me start by introducing maybe the reason why I'm writing. In 12th grade, I had a English teacher in high school. Her name was Mrs. Lentz. I don't know if she's around anymore, but I'll give you one little detail about her. A friend of mine and I we sat up toward the front. She always wore like a dress that went to like below her knees. Occasionally, you know, when she'd sit a certain way, you could see that she shaved her legs only from her knees down. And she was much hairier than we were in high school. Anyway, so after that image, sorry. I think she's great. What she had was, we had a regular class of whatever we did. I don't remember. English stuff. But we also then
were supposed to... where was this? Where did you go to high school?
This was in Columbia, Maryland. Of smack dab in the middle between Baltimore and D.C., a planned community. I forget exactly why we ended up moving there, but it was actually a pretty good place. Anyway, so we all had to get those composition notebooks, those black marbled kind of things. Mm-hmm. And each week we were supposed to write something in there, and she would read it, and if she liked it, you would get a check plus. Now, what that really meant was if you're between grades, like a C and a B, and you had a couple check pluses in your composition book, it would bump you up. So it was like a way to help your grade. So I, over the year, I mean, I started writing just little, you know, one page, little stupid things. I don't even remember. But toward the middle of the year, I started writing much longer pieces kind of based on characters in the class. And what would happen is people in the class got interested. I don't remember exactly how. Maybe I shared it once and someone said, oh, wait, you're writing about us. We want to see more. And my notebook would get passed around and the entries got longer and longer. And by the end of the year, I was writing 20 pages a week in there of just made up, you know, stuff, mainly about the other kids in the class. That was really the beginning. I've never quite looked back. What I wrote came in different forms. Next, I wanted to be a screenplay writer and wrote a bunch of terrible, unmakeable, unreadable screenplays.
How did you find that experience versus prose?
It probably was detrimental in that when you're writing a screenplay, you're writing only the tiniest bit of description and the rest is all dialogue. Dialogue comes pretty easily to me. I mean, I think I could like make up a conversation between two people and just go on and on and on and on. And that's a lot of what I had written. So there wasn't a lot of structure or maybe even interest in those things. But after a while, I got tired of the idea that these would never be produced. And, you know, this is long before YouTube. I couldn't imagine, you know, making them myself. So I thought, well, I'll just switch to novels. But for years and years, maybe even decades, the novels were kind of badly written screenplays with not a lot of description and a lot of dialogue. And it took a number of workshops and a lot of people haranguing me before I started working much harder at producing a more traditional shaped novel.
And where were some of these workshops at? Were any of them some of the science fiction workshops like Clarion?
No, I didn't do that. Some of the workshops are from college. I studied at the University of Pittsburgh is where I took a number of classes. I remember I handed in like a 90-page, I don't know, I guess it would be a novella. And I remember the professor saying, well, this is, you know, it's a lot of words. That's back when you're starting out. I mean, just having like 15 pages is a lot. You know, I had 90. And that was really right. All I had was 90 pages. No one could figure out what was going on. I think the professor called it a Tower of Babel. And I thought, well, okay. But it took, you know, years of hearing bad, you know, getting bad reviews from readers before I really could sit down and see it for what it was. The other workshops, there was a workshop at the 72nd Street Y in New York. And it was a class about rewriting, something which I never did, you know. And that was the first time I really, that professor who I still know and adore, she's a writer, Marina Budos is her name. She was the one who really kind of, you know, I want to say beat me up and you know, tried to get me on track. I mean, she then later created a separate writing workshop just for people who are working on novels. Because it's a very different thing. If you're going to a class, everyone else is writing a short story, and you're bringing in a chapter of a novel, they want very different things from it. You know, a short story is going to resolve in those 15 to 20 pages. A chapter may do the opposite and try and ask the reader more questions than it's ever going to answer. So that was great, having a novel workshop and having her... there were a couple of phrases that they would come in and I'd hear every time, like, we like this, we just want more. And it was, you know, me glossing over like the descriptions and kind of the emotional rhythm of a story and tending to just fly along on dialogue. So This is very painful, Jeff. I wish you hadn't brought this up. It really, in a funny way, it kind of is, because I spent so many years, and I sometimes look back and think, I was so stupid. The one problem, if people are starting out writing, write short stories, because as Douglas Lane, I had a conversation with he about this, and he said, it's an opportunity to fail faster. Because it would take me a year and a half to write a novel, and then I would get feedback on it and think, oh, this is terrible. I can't. I can't go and start writing it again. I've got a better idea. And so I'd write another one and learn just what I could have on a short story in maybe, I don't know, a month. So that's my advice out there, short stories.
And I'm curious, have you ever gone back and tried to mine any of those those novels or attempts at novels?
You know, I thought about that recently because I've finished the third in this kind of trilogy. It's Gray Yarn, and the third is called Loom. It's not finished, but I have the draft written. So I was kind of figuring out what would I do next, and I was thinking back to some of them. And the problem is, there's not a lot to steal from. You know, I'd love to steal from myself. I mean, some of them, like a cool idea is a sentence or two, and that was all I was going on. I haven't, though, looked at them. A lot of them are probably just gone. I mean, they were on hard disks or floppy disks.
Yeah. So, have you ever thought about it? I mean, you know, obviously you said it was painful to think about, you know, spending that time and then, you know, having a work that was primarily dialogue and you know, not as much story. But I'm curious if you've ever thought about what kept you going during those years and those workshops and those attempts at various novels.
A precise mix of coffee and beer is what kept me going, Jeff. I wanted it. I wasn't going to give up. I mean, I just was going to keep trying. That's all, you know. I mean, I certainly had times when I was just like, I can't do this. I give up. And I would not write for a while. But invariably, I felt like I can't not do it. I had to try again. I'd get some inspiration and think, aha, now I understand it. You know, and of course I didn't most of the time, but.
Right. I'm curious, I mean, given that the two books, Gray and Yarn, and then you mentioned Loom, and the fact that you are up for the Philip K. Dick Award. I'm not sure, is it nominee? Is that how you would refer to it?
I guess so.
As you were writing those various novels, were they science fiction, or is that something that you came to later, or was that always kind of there?
Here's what I think the answer is. Gray started back in college as a short story. I don't have that piece anymore. It was very different from what the book turned out to be. But that was the one thing that I would keep going back to and fiddle around with. Everything else I kind of would just, once I was finished with it, I didn't think there was anything to work with again, you know, so I would leave them up by the side, like I said. But I would return to Gray, and after I came back from Japan, I wrote another draft of it. I changed it from a short story into a novel with some of the stuff I'd experienced in Japan. And partly being, you know, just back from Japan, my head was science fiction. I mean, Japan seemed like science fiction mostly to me. But a lot of what I wrote otherwise was not. Some were trying to be thrillers. Some were really kind of mainstream. I mean, I came very close to getting a book published that was mainstream. It was a kind of a coming of age story, you know, kind of like the first book everyone is supposed to write. I had some other agents kind of interested in it. They liked the writing, but the story wasn't still quite strong enough. And then I had...
Sorry, you're breaking up. Gray, I didn't hear that.
And she thought it was wonderful. And she said, oh, well, I know an agent who might like this, who's And I was introduced at a party, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Great.
Did that answer the question?
Have you always read science fiction? Have you been a fan of the genre?
I never considered myself any kind of a fan, really. I just read what appealed to me. But what appealed to me was a lot of Gibson and Dick and I'm blanking on the guy that is who wrote Crash. Oh my God,
Stevenson,
J.G. Ballard.
Oh, gotcha. I was thinking of Snow Crash.
Right. That kind of stuff is appealed to me greatly. I still though read. I mean, I used to always say my favorite author is maybe, you know, Nabokov, although I haven't reread him in years and years and years. And some of his stuff I can't stand and can't read. But I read a whole bunch of different things. I also think that another huge influence on me was early on when I was like in junior high school, I was trying to read Buckminster Fuller. He was the inventor, thinker, philosopher, perhaps even, you know, wacko to some degree.
Right.
And that probably reads a bit like sci-fi in a way. I remember just loving it, but I'm sure I didn't understand half of it.
I don't think he understood half of it. The geodesic dome.
Yeah, geodesic dome. And then the other thing, he had all these what were called dimaction. That was a word he'd invented. And he had the dimaction car, a dimaction bathroom. I mean, he's just... I use some of those kinds of things in my books. I mean, I think in some place I mentioned a fog shower, I think, and that's a Buckminster Fuller idea of saving water by taking, you know, not having running water, but a fog mist kind of a thing is what he described. So I still steal from old Bucky.
Well, we're recording this podcast the day after Borders Books, one of the two major book retailing chains in the U.S., declared bankruptcy. With the rapid adoption of e-books, the book publishing industry is undergoing a lot of change very quickly. Is it something that you give much thought to in terms of the business of publishing? And I'm curious what your thinking is about e-books.
I haven't given it a ton of thought. I do read a number of books on my iPod Touch, a lot for the podcast because I'm reading, the industry does give PDF galleys, I think, because it's almost free, I would guess, you know, to instead of printing galleys and sending them out. So I've read a number of books that way that were pretty inconvenient to read, quite frankly. I just finished one where I had a watermark on every page, you know, that said property of blah, blah, blah. And it was in kind of dark gray. And there were times when I had to zoom in and think, what are these words here? But I got through it. It was a very enjoyable book. I love the idea that I have 100 novels in my pocket if I'm somewhere and have time and I can read. But I've also gotten paper galley books these, you know, recently. And sometimes they're just a joy to read, to sit down and have that sense of the book in your hand, the weight, the pages, the typography is so much more readable and beautiful most often.
Without a doubt.
But, you know, I mean, I don't know. granted, it's all going digital. I mean, there's no question. I mean, when's the last time you bought a CD? I mean,
oh yeah, yep.
And even having one is a burden. I mean,
agreed. I totally agree. I mean, I think it's inevitable. And there was a story in the New York Times about a week and a half ago about the number of preteens and teens who received e-readers for the holidays, this past holiday, and the growth in YA literature in ebook format. So right there, you're going to have a next generation who thinks nothing of reading on a device. But I'm also much more skeptical of various pundits who have said, you know, by 2015, you're not going to be able to, you know, you're not going to see bookstores. I think that's wildly not the case.
Wait, a pundit is wrong?
I think so. I think we alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I'm curious if you have advice for writers who are trying to publish their own novels or short stories, given your own experiences as you've kind of detailed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said before, work on short stories, even though, you know, placing a short story is very difficult. But it can be done. I mean, there's also a lot of respected internet places where you can place it. But more importantly, it's about, you know, learning and just going through and trying different things much faster than writing novels. But the other thing, I remember when I was, you know, writing stuff out there, the idea of getting an agent loomed so big in my head and was, in the end, so unimportant that I know I spent all sorts of time and money and effort worrying about that before it needed to be worried about. I mean, I used to buy those, what were those things? Those agent resources, or I forget.
Yes. Jeff Herman's guide.
Yeah. I bought those and I would get them as presents from family. You know, they all thought that was, that was the key. But the key is having something that an agent is going to want. And getting it to them is actually not the hard part. I mean, getting good enough so that you can be coveted by agents is the hard part. I mean, when I had that, and I didn't even quite know it, you know, I just sent it to her. I mean, you know, and that was it. It was insanely easy. Now, I had someone who recommended it, but we all, you know, it's at 6 degrees of separation.
Sure.
Even if you're in the middle of the country, it makes no difference. You know someone who knows someone. I mean, the internet has made that completely a moot point. It's all, to me, it's all about getting good stuff on the page and making, you know, your writing excellent. That's hard. But the rest of the stuff is not so terribly hard. And all the energy I spent on it was wasted. I mean, all the postage. Basically, what I did was send out stuff that wasn't that good. And didn't really know it and didn't realize it and wasted time on postage and wasted their time and blah, blah, blah. That was all needless.
Right. Well, great. Well, again, I've been speaking with John Armstrong, author of the new novel Yarn, available at your local bookstore or online. And you can also check out his podcast if you're just joining us. John, where can people find you online besides the podcast?
My name, John Armstrong, and I spell J, as soon as I say that, I think I don't spell it. My parents, you know, spelled it for me. My parents named me J-O-N, John Armstrong. So if you can Google John Armstrong, there are a couple other John Armstrongs. And in fact, early on in the podcast, I did one where it was called the high-ranking Google John Armstrongs, you know, J-O-N Armstrong, because there's a designer and a magician who I had seen, you know, when I... What was that called? Ego surfed. I'd say, well, who's this magician with my name? And so I called them up and spoke with both of them. And it was interesting because they both knew of me, of course, because they'd Googled their own name and I'd come up. And who's this dude? What's he about? So it was a kind of a funny gathering of, you know, seeing kind of like the shadow of someone else with your name online and trying to suss out who they were and what they were doing. That was a fun show.
That's great. That's great. I guess I don't remember that one. That's a wonderful idea.
I was thinking of doing it again because it was early enough that my recording prowess was not that great. And I think one of the guys was on a cell phone. And I think I'd like duct taped a microphone to, you know, a phone to get the audio on that side. And it was, you know, not very good. So I have better techniques now. But anyway.
Well, great. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to be on.
This is Lee Child, and I'm listening to the Reading and Writing Podcast.
Thanks for listening to my latest podcast. If you have a chance, please leave a review of the podcast in iTunes. It only takes a moment. Until next time, read some good books and be well.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.